Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome to episode 35 of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. With me, as always, your host, Francesca. So in last week's episode, I talked about how the hormonal changes we experience during perimenopause impact all 12 body systems. And we went through those 12 body systems in the previous episode. So do go back and listen to that if you haven't yet, because this one does follow on really nicely from that episode. And just to recap the two major hormonal shifts that we're experiencing in perimenopause that's impacting all 12 body systems are, firstly, that progesterone begins to decline. So this is happening from late 30s, but definitely by early 40s, because ovulation, which is how we make progesterone, becomes less regular. So we're more likely to not achieve that ovulation each cycle, like we as often as we might have done in our 20s and 30s, and or the ovulation process becomes less robust, and as a result we're making less progesterone. And then the other thing that's happening is that estrogen starts fluctuating erratically, often becoming higher than it ever was before it eventually starts a more steady decline in the later stages of perimenopause, so closer towards actually going 12 full months without having a period. That's really when that decline genuinely starts. In the earlier phases of perimenopause, we tend to have higher levels of estrogen than ever before, but it's the fluctuating nature, sharp highs, sharp drops, that are causing a lot of the hormonal havoc, essentially a lot of the symptoms, and then impacting those 12 body systems as well, alongside that declining progesterone. So these shifts, they don't just affect our cycles, our menstrual cycles or our periods, they influence how every single cell, tissue and system in the body is functioning. And that's because estrogen and progesterone interact with receptors all over the body and the brain. In that episode, I also touched on how these hormonal changes can trigger or intensify autoimmune conditions. And I'll introduce you to the concept of the autoimmune triad, which is a framework described by Italian gastroenterologist and researcher Dr. Alessio Fasano. Now, according to him, there are three key ingredients required for a person to develop an autoimmune condition. The first one is having a genetic predisposition. The second one is increased intestinal permeability. This is something also known as leaky gut, which I'm going to explain in today's episode. And the third one is a trigger, so particularly stress, some kind of infection, viral or bacterial, hormonal shifts like those during perimenopause and also postnatally, or an environmental exposure, which we're also going to talk about in today's episode. We're going to zoom in on the last two, leaky gut and the common autoimmune triggers. So first, let's just quickly revisit what an autoimmune condition actually is. So autoimmune diseases occur when the immune system mistakenly attacks the body's own tissues, and then that leads to inflammation, damage, and loss of function of those tissues. So depending on which part of the body is targeted, it can manifest in different ways. So for example, Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So this is when the immune system is attacking the thyroid gland, the tissues of the thyroid gland. This is a really common cause of hypothyroidism. So many cases are going kind of unnoticed or undiagnosed. A person could have been diagnosed with hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, and maybe be given T4. I spoke about this in the previous episode. But actually, they're kind of missing that the underlying cause of that hypothyroidism is the fact that there is this Hashimoto's thyroiditis going on. The other example would be rheumatoid arthritis, which targets the joints. Then we have lupus, which affects the skin, joints, kidneys, heart, and other organs. Type 1 diabetes, which destroys insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. Multiple sclerosis, which damages the protective sheath around nerve fibers. So now that we've done that little recap, let's just dive into those two big pieces of that autoimmune puzzle. So that the first one is intestinal permeability, also known as leaky gut. So let me just explain what this is, because this really does underlie so much chronic disease and particularly autoimmunity, but also various symptoms that we might experience like brain fog, fatigue, and so on. So intestinal permeability basically means So under normal conditions, the lining of your small intestine is made up of tightly packed cells. So these are known as tight junctions. They're very, very cells that are very, very tightly packed together, almost sticking together. And they're so tightly packed that it only allows properly digested nutrients to pass through into the bloodstream, to be absorbed into the body for use, you know, for all the different cells to use those nutrients. Everything else stays out. But when this gut lining becomes compromised or weakened, whether through diet, stress, certain medications, other factors, those tight junctions start to loosen. They get wider. And that starts to allow larger particles like undigested food, bacteria, toxins, and pathogens to cross into the bloodstream where they simply don't belong. They should all remain within the gut. They will be passed out via bowel movements. We don't want things like pathogens to be living in the gut, but if they are, we certainly don't want them to be passing through into the bloodstream, into the rest of the body. So that breach essentially triggers an immune response by your immune system, because your immune system now sees these substances as invaders. It sees them as foreign invaders that shouldn't be in the bloodstream. And then it responds. It responds accordingly. So it's doing the right thing. But that response leads to chronic inflammation. And it, in genetically susceptible people, that can tip the scale towards autoimmunity. Now, this can obviously happen any time in life. It's not a perimenopause specific situation. Having gut permeability can happen to anyone at any time. And it is very common. So what's important to know is that that gut lining, it also known as the gut wall, intestinal wall, is part of your immune system. The lining isn't just a passive barrier, it's an active part of your immune defense. And inside that lining is a complex network of cells called the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, also known as GALT, G-A-L-T. And that actually houses about 75% of your body's immune cells, and it produces around 80% of your immunoglobulins, which are the antibodies, various antibodies in the body that fight off pathogens, antibodies of the immune system. And there are also immune, what we could nickname scouts, if you like. So these are they're called toll-like receptors or TLRs, and they sit along the gut lining and they help identify dangerous substances. They're kind of like, I kind of liken them to, I can't think of the word, army men just kind of like sitting around an entrance to a building, for example. And they sit along that gut lining. They're looking for dangerous substances all the time, always scanning. And when they're constantly being triggered, say by particles slipping through a leaky gut or a permeable gut lining, they send the signal to release inflammatory compounds. Examples of those would be histamine, that then lead to systemic inflammation and various histamine-like symptoms. You know, it could be rashes, hot flush, it could be red flush, flushing in the face, fatigue, brain fog, insomnia, achy joints. And that's why an unhealthy gut can lead to a wide range of those symptoms that we specifically link to perimenopause, way beyond digestion, like that fatigue, brain fog, insomnia, achy joints, histamine-like symptoms. They are linked to, they're linked to gut health, but we tend to see them as just separate perimenopause symptoms. But actually, if we go back and address gut health, we can relieve or really minimize so many of these different symptoms that we might be experiencing. So even if we don't have obvious gut symptoms, like I have a lot of clients who fill in, when they fill in my intake form, or even just when we speak, they'll say, I don't have any gut issues. My gut health's fine because I don't have any gut symptoms. Like I don't have bloating or flatulence or diarrhea or constipation or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that a person doesn't have an unhealthy gut or, a permeable gut lining, because all of these other symptoms I just mentioned can link back to gut permeability. So common causes of this gut permeability, or also known as leaky gut, a diet high in refined carbohydrates, sort of refined white flour products specifically. So lots of things like, bagels, wraps, your kind of white flour, wheat-based products, and also ultra-processed foods. So not just simple processed foods like a hummus, for example, which is essentially a processed food. I'm talking about those ultra-processed foods like your sort of cereal bars, protein bars, your crisps, biscuits, cakes, all those sorts of things that have been highly processed and made to last forever. Also chronic stress, alcohol, gut dysbiosis, also known as imbalanced microbiome, so just imbalances in the bacteria that should be housed in the gut. Certain medications like, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, for example, and constant antibiotics or frequent antibiotics or a history of antibiotics previously. Eating too frequently, so there's sort of no time for the gut lining to repair itself and close up its holes, because every time we eat, those holes become temporarily widened or leaky, if you like, to allow those nutrients to be absorbed into the bloodstream. But then after a time, they should close themselves back up and become tight. But if we're eating too often, we're calling for them to widen too often, and they get less time to repair back to their tightness. And in some people, gluten, particularly highly processed forms of gluten, can be a trigger for leaky gut as well. And then common triggers for autoimmunity. So we've talked about that triad is a genetic predisposition, gut permeability, and triggers, any particular sort of environmental triggers. So these particular triggers that need our attention are... They're just really important to understand, because they are that third key ingredient in that autoimmune triad. Even with a genetic predisposition, which is the first ingredient, autoimmunity doesn't happen without some kind of environmental or internal trigger. So, for example, in my family, there is a genetic predisposition on my mum's side for rheumatoid arthritis. But it doesn't mean that I will naturally have autoimmune, automatically develop or be suffering from rheumatoid arthritis now. So far, I say touch wood, at 45, I have no signs of rheumatoid arthritis when I, in terms of symptoms or checking blood work, for example. But so just because I have that genetic predisposition doesn't mean that I'm automatically going to get it, because even with that genetic predisposition, autoimmunity isn't triggered without some kind of internal or environmental trigger. So that trigger could be what we just mentioned, leaky gut. So I'm always staying on top of my gut health. But also the most common environmental ones would be, or in other internal ones would be, stress, infection, so viral or bacterial, hormonal shifts, for example, perimenopause, that shift in estrogen, its fluctuating nature, the decline in progesterone can trigger it. And that's why it's so common that autoimmunity is discovered or triggered when a woman is in her 40s, particularly Hashimoto's thyroiditis or rheumatoid arthritis. Environmental exposures would be things like chemicals, toxins, and pollutants. But let's unpack each one of those one by one. So chronic stress, why does chronic stress act as a trigger potentially? So ongoing emotional or physical stress puts your body in this constant state of fight or flight. And that elevates cortisol, or just regulates cortisol levels. Cortisol is a wonderful hormone, but when it's dysregulated or elevated, it becomes inflammatory and it can start to weaken the immune system's regulatory functions. Over time, it can suppress the immune system as well. And over time, that sort of dysregulation can increase susceptibility to autoimmune flare-ups or even kickstart the process in the first place. That's why it's a trigger. And then the hormonal shifts, this is a big one, as I've said a million times, particularly during perimenopause, because estrogen plays a really key role in modulating immune activity. And when its levels start to fluctuate, and they start to drop as well in later perimenopause, immune balance can then be disrupted. And some women even notice autoimmune conditions appearing for the first time or worsening during perimenopause or postnatally. That's quite a common time as well, because these are both really significant hormonal change times. A lot of my clients will come to me because they're starting to experience autoimmune conditions that they've been diagnosed with, or their autoimmune symptoms that they're particularly worried about. And obviously they're not coming to me for a diagnosis, but they're coming to me to see if nutritionally and lifestyle wise, is there anything they can do to sort of prevent it from continuing to flare, getting worse, or being diagnosed in the first place. And there is so much that we can do, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then we've got infection. So what I mean by this, as I said, is viral or bacterial infections. Certain viral or bacterial infections have been linked to autoimmune conditions in genetically predisposed people. So again, if you're genetically predisposed and you have one of these viruses or bacterial infections, and let's say you're also in perimenopause and you also suffer, going through chronic stress, and you're also maybe not having a diet that's conducive to, minimizing your risk of autoimmunity, and you have leaky gut, then yes, it could be likely that that you would flare or trigger an autoimmune condition. So examples of the viruses would be Epstein-Barr virus, also known as EBV. That's associated with conditions like lupus and multiple sclerosis. Even certain types of flu can be linked to autoimmunity in some people. And then examples of bacterial infections would include H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori. That's associated with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. And then the bacteria that's behind Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, that can trigger or worsen autoimmune conditions. And then when we're talking about environmental toxins, what I mean by that is basically we're exposed to a wide range of environmental chemicals in our modern life through food, air, water, and personal care products as well, which we talk about in terms of being in, endocrine or hormone disrupting chemicals. And some examples of known or suspected triggering environmental chemicals are heavy metals, particularly mercury, arsenic, and lead, pesticides, air pollutants, and industrial chemicals. If you're somebody who lives in kind of these big industrial towns, for example, or, you know, high traffic. I've just left London for the first time in 45 years, and I grew up on a very, very busy main road, and I've just spent as well the last 12 years living on a very busy main road as well in a busy area. So my air pollutant status is probably through the roof, as much as we had all these different air purifiers in the house. But now we've moved over to Margate for, you know, much purer sea air. So hopefully that will do me some good. And then smoking, excess alcohol, and UV radiation. These have been linked to potentially triggering autoimmunity because they can damage tissues, they can increase inflammation, and they can essentially confuse the immune system signaling. And that can sort of start to pave the way for autoimmune reactions. But as I said, it's important to remember that it's usually a combination of these factors that tips the balance. One single trigger is usually not enough to full-blown, you know, put somebody into an autoimmune state. But if you already have autoimmunity, then maybe just adding in another trigger will just add to flare-ups. And if you can address that trigger and or some other triggers as well, you can reduce those flare-ups and keep autoimmunity at bay, definitely. But when, you know, like I say, when there's chronic stress, poor gut health, gut permeability, leaky gut, exposure to infections or toxins all in one, and you're perimenopausal, that's when autoimmunity may develop or flare. So let's now talk about the positive side of things, which is what you can do, because I don't want anyone to feel overwhelmed or worried. This is just, you know, how things are. You know, I'm just kind of empowering you with that knowledge of what could be going on. But the good news is that there are practical things that we can do. We can support our immune system. We can support our gut health. And essentially, there are some really powerful lifestyle and nutrition changes that help to prevent or stabilize autoimmunity, especially during perimenopause. So it really comes down to two core things: supporting gut health and repairing this intestinal permeability. We want it those tight junctions to get nice and tight again. So those gaps just aren't there anymore. And we want to reduce or remove triggers like stress, like infections, like environmental toxins and hormonal imbalances. Now, we can't take perimenopause away. It is happening. It's a natural phase. It's the, you know, the road towards eventually achieving menopause. But there are lots of things that we can do. And that's what this whole podcast is about. My blog, my work, everything that I do with clients, my monthly subscription. There's lots of things that we can be doing to support the changes in estrogen and progesterone and support the body with those changes. So that is what we can really be focusing on. We can't obviously take perimenopause away, but we can support the body to handle it much, much better. And therefore, that would be kind of reducing one of those triggers. So in my practice, I use a functional medicine 5R gut reset model. To guide this process, basically, of healing the gut, repairing intestinal permeability, improving gut health as a whole. So let me just walk you through what those 5 R's are. It's basically 5 steps. They all begin with R, and there's, you know, little things to do within them. So the first one is reset. So this is about resetting the diet and lifestyle habits to create the right environment for gut healing. So basically, in a nutshell, it means chewing your food thoroughly. So we tend to overthink a lot of the things that we need to do for, you know, gut health, solving this issue and that issue. And we're going down these rabbit holes online, on Instagram. We're looking for the next best supplement. Really, it comes down to chewing your food thoroughly. If you're not eating, if you're not chewing every single mouthful to almost liquid before you swallow, but then you're out there looking for the next best supplement, it's just not going to work. It's not really going to touch the sides if you're not chewing your food thoroughly. That is the absolute first step, because digestive health really starts in the brain and the mouth. So allowing your brain to understand that there's food there, and as a result, it starts to produce saliva in the mouth. It tells the saliva glands in the mouth to start releasing that saliva. And then we mix that saliva with the food and we chew it really, 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 really well before we swallow that mouthful, and so on until we've finished our food, which will take a lot longer than we're used to. I have to remind myself every day, every single meal, chew and take your time, relax. And then that mixes together, that saliva and that food, we chew it to liquid and we swallow it. That is where digestion starts, and we have to work from that top down. The next thing is to avoid eating when you're stressed or on the go, simply because, you know, for the reason that you're unlikely to chew your food very well when you're stressed or on the go, you're just going to hoover it down. But also when you're stressed or on the go, your digestive system is not going to be switched on. The brain is not thinking, oh, it's time to switch on the digestive system and allow the blood supply to go there so that this person can digest their food. Your brain's like, well, no, this person's stressed, this person's on the go, they're not eating. So, it, you know, we just don't have those digestive processes in place. Prioritizing good sleep, because sleep impacts cortisol levels. It's like another stressor, essentially. And then supporting our nervous system, you know, to manage and reduce stress. And I've got lots of episodes on, you know, chronic stress, managing cortisol, the four foundational pillars that I work on with every single client and within my membership. The fourth pillar, or the third, I can't remember what number pillar, is managing stress and supporting your nervous system. So go through previous episodes and you'll find a good few episodes on that. You can look at my blog, you can download the free guide from my website, which goes through those four pillars, and there's nervous system stuff in there. The second R is replace and support. So here we're supporting your digestion with the things that might be missing. So for example, a lot of people have low stomach acid, contrary to popular belief, where people think it's all about high stomach acid, or your GP might say it's high stomach acid and want to put you on some kind of antacid. Lots of people are actually struggling with low stomach acid. So stress causes low stomach acid, you know, various ways of eating, and perimenopause as well can lead to low stomach acid. So stomach acid is usually missing. It's something we want to replace and support. Digestive enzymes are usually very helpful for many people. Again, if stomach acid's low, digestive enzymes will be low as well. When we're eating, it's less likely that we're going to produce as many of the right digestive enzymes that we need. And bile acids, if they're low. So these can all be taken in supplement form, you know, alongside a healthy diet and eating, chewing each mouthful really well. They can be really helpful. And it doesn't have to be forever, but it's usually a kind of plan that I'll put a client on for maybe 3 to 6 months while we're really just working on getting their digestive health back to its optimal. And then the other thing we might want to replace and support would be probiotics to help restore that the beneficial bacterial balance in the gut, which is usually, if somebody has poor gut health, lots of stress, a leaky gut, they're unlikely to have good levels of beneficial bacteria. And then the third R is remove. So this step is about removing anything that could be inflaming or damaging, kind of weakening that gut lining. For example, gluten, so highly processed gluten specifically, is not very helpful for the gut lining. It can kind of, I kind of liken it to sort of just throwing flames onto that gut lining, like just insulting it and weakening, widening those holes. The A1 casein protein found in cow's milk particularly can be quite inflammatory. In some people, many people, it can convert into an inflammatory compound. And what's great to know is that sheep's and goat's milk doesn't have this A1 protein. It has A2, which isn't found to be inflammatory. So I personally use cheeses from, I don't drink milk anyway, I don't use milk. But when it comes to cheeses, I specifically look for cheeses that are made with sheep and cows. That includes my feta cheese, my halloumi, Manchego cheese is made from sheep's milk anyway, but feta and halloumi, I just always check the labels, because some can be made from cow's milk, some is a mix, and some is purely made from goats and sheep's, and that's what I go for. And then also sugar, so all your, you know, any kind of confectionery, regular white sugar, that, you know, sugar generally, can be quite inflammatory for the gut. Refined carbohydrates, I mentioned earlier, like your white flour products, your cakes, your bagels, wraps, pastries, you know, white breads, baguettes, etc., pizza bases, all of these white flour products, your ultra processed foods, cereal bars, protein bars, all of these kind of processed bars and foods. Alcohol and caffeine can be, particularly from coffee, can be quite inflaming. It doesn't mean that you can't drink caffeine and there's never a place for it, because of course there is. It's just there's nuances with all of these things. So if you are suffering with a leaky gut, it might just be something that would be helpful to reduce or remove for a while. Some people will benefit from removing the FODMAP family of foods. So these are fermentable sort of carbohydrates and sugars in different types of foods, particularly vegetables, fruits, that will ferment in the gut, and then they basically increase the situation of inflammation and damage to the gut lining. So this would, if somebody is looking to get to eliminate FODMAP foods, it would need to be short term only, and ideally under professional guidance, working with someone like myself, nutritional therapist, functional medicine practitioner, because it's so limiting. It leaves your diet so limited in terms of, you know, vegetables, really important fiber rich foods, that you don't want to do it long term, and you may not need to get rid of all of the FODMAP foods. You know, if you're working with a professional like myself, like somebody similar to me, they can help you with what you might need to get, you know, eliminate for a while and what you don't. And then also we might be looking to remove potential pathogens like harmful bacteria, yeasts or parasites, which in my practice, and any other nutritional therapist practitioner as well, would identify through comprehensive stool testing. I use a lab called Genova Diagnostic. I love their GIFX test. It's the most common one that I do with myself, with clients. And that helps to identify any potential harmful bacteria, any yeast, any parasites. You know, we may use some sort of targeted antimicrobials or herbs to address them. We may not. It kind of just depends. Every single person is completely different. There isn't just kind of one protocol. But those are the potential sort of things that we're looking for and looking to remove. The fourth R is rebalance. So now we work on kind of rebalancing your gut microbiome by encouraging that diversity and abundance of the beneficial protective bacteria. The fifth step is repair, the fifth R. So this is all about helping your gut lining heal and strengthen. So we tackle all those other things first, 1 to 3 R's, really sort of trying to optimize the digestive health, optimizing the gut flora and that microbiome. We're looking to rebalance, and then we're looking at repairing, healing and strengthening that gut lining. And we do this using some really key nutrients like vitamin D. We always want to get our levels tested, though. I always suggest people test their levels every sort of 6 months or so, and then take, you know, supplement dose according to that level and where it needs to be. Vitamin A, but particularly in its retinol form, we get vitamin A in the form of beta carotene, which is from kind of orange and yellow fruits and vegetables, but really we're looking for the retinol form. So this is the active form that does the sort of repair work on your tissues essentially, and linings, including the gut lining. So chicken livers, for example, is really rich in retinol. So if you like chicken livers, do try and eat more of them. And it's obviously a relatively cheap as well cut of meat to use. It's so, so beneficial. You can also supplement, you know, with retinol form of vitamin A. And then nutrients like glutamine, zinc carnosine, N-acetylglucosamine, also known as NAG, deglycerized licorice, also known as DGL, aloe vera, slippery elm, omega-3s, particularly EPA and DHA, which is found in oily fish, or also found in some algae, but it's definitely more potent in oily fish. So these are a really great collection of nutrients that you would find in, say, a gut healing supplement powder or something. Bone broth, really, really helpful, made by simmering chicken or beef bones for 24 hours on a very low heat. And that process makes a real a broth that's rich in collagen, proline, glycine and glutamine, which are some real gut healing, gut lining, anti-inflammatory compounds, basically. They're absolutely fantastic for healing the gut. And I tend to, when I work with clients who are going to use bone broth therapeutically, obviously we can cook with it, we can use it in gravies and sauces and soups, that's great too. But if we're using it therapeutically, we kind of want to have it as like our morning coffee on an empty stomach, you know, just heat up a cup's worth of your bone broth and drink it like you would a cup of tea or a coffee in the morning. And then collagen powder as well can be helpful to help support gut lining as well. So let's now have a look at how this all translates into food. So some practical nutrition tips for supporting those five R's are to be looking for protein-rich anti-inflammatory foods. So when we're looking at meats, it's great to be going for grass-fed beef and lamb, if possible, free-range chicken, free-range turkey, wild oily fish like salmon, sardines, mackerel, herring, trout. So a few years ago, I did some research into a really, really sort of good farms that would deliver to my area. And I would do a monthly meat box order that would come once a month. It was so easy. And luckily, I have enough freezer space. I know some people are challenged with that if they have bigger families or smaller freezers. But we definitely had the space for it. So I started ordering a monthly meat box from Piper's Farm. And I handpicked my own meats, and I would get my grass-fed, organic, regeneratively farmed, which is good for the environment, beef and lamb. I'd get my free-range chicken thighs, some turkey, some chicken breast. And then I would just, in my normal weekly shop, from the supermarket, I would get my wild salmon and things like tinned salmon, tinned wild salmon, tinned sardines, tinned mackerel, and all those things from there. Free-range, preferably organic eggs, but definitely free-range. High quality protein powders, whey isolate if you can tolerate it. Or, you know, if you're worried about the sort of milk protein, whey isolate is not as kind of A1 casein heavy as whey concentrate. But for some people, they may still want to avoid whey completely. So plant-based blends with, for example, a blend of brown rice protein and pea protein to help make a more complete protein, but making sure it's unflavored, no fillers, you know, no artificial sweeteners, and just using that in a smoothie with something like, you know, some good quality, good fats, some berries and some water. And then plenty of non-starchy, colourful vegetables, herbs, spices, berries. So aim for half your plate in at least two meals per day. Use a handful of berries, I have a protein smoothie at one point during the day, depending on what's going on for me in the week and what day. So things like raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, I just get them, I leave them in the freezer frozen. These are rich in antioxidants, lovely anti-inflammatory plant compounds, and all your different colours and types of vegetables, your greens, oranges, reds, yellows, browns, whites. Just really making sure when you're doing your weekly shop, whether it's online or in the supermarket, that you're looking, okay, you've got loads of greens, hopefully, lots of different green leafy vegetable types, but what else can you get in there in terms of colour? Can you get different colour bell peppers? Can you get red cabbage, white cabbage, green cabbage, you know, cauliflower and broccoli, maybe red onions instead of brown or both, your garlic, what other colours are there now? I'm thinking butternut squash, you know, carrots, can lovely to sort of grate carrots into salads, beetroot, grate that into salads as well. And you can really up the amount of sort of different colours that you're having throughout the week, and herbs and spices as well. Fresh and dried all counts. And then what I really love is the nutrient dense starchy carbohydrates. So when we're having our carbohydrate portion of our meal, instead of it just being something that's, you know, lacking in fiber and maybe high in white flour and basically anti-nutrients, basically there's nothing very good in that carb, why not couple your carb with something that's, make it something from that's really nutrient dense, provides lots of fiber, which helps feed your gut bacteria, and also provides a lot of these different phytonutrients, antioxidants that help to support the anti-inflammatory side of things. So things like beetroot, carrot, sweet potato, baby new potatoes, squash, pumpkin, whole grains like red, wild or brown rice, quinoa, buckwheat. These are really good sources for your lunch and dinner sort of carbohydrate option. Good fats, plenty of extra virgin olive oil, avocado, ground flaxseed, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, sesame seeds, chia seeds. These are lovely anti-inflammatory fats, but they're also just so great for supporting the cells in the body and the brain, and then the cells of the lining as well. Or organic grass-fed butter. So never using margarine, always using real butter, preferably organic and grass-fed. All the oily fish I just mentioned, salmon, mackerel, sardines, herring, trout, coconut milk, coconut oil, MCT oil, lovely things to be putting into smoothies, you know, putting over your meals, using in cooking. And then prebiotic and probiotic fibers. So we have prebiotic fibers are the types of fibers from various foods that help to allow the probiotic, the live bacteria, beneficial bacteria, to grow and thrive. So examples of prebiotic fibers that you can eat are onions, garlic, leeks, asparagus, Jerusalem artichoke. Other sorts of prebiotic fibers are what's known as resistant starches. So these are starches that help to basically form that basis for prebiotic fiber that allows that beneficial bacteria to thrive. And we actually find resistant starches in potatoes and rice that have been cooked and then cooled. So great for like potato salads, using rice cold in a salad the next day. You know, really good for those of us who batch cook. It's great to be using things cooled and don't bother heating them up again, just have them cool. Green bananas, raw potato starch, which you can buy in powder form. We find resistant starches naturally in seeds, nuts, in the skin of the seeds, nuts, legumes, and whole grains. Also, we can buy resistant starch powders like inulin. So those are great for forming the basis of that live bacteria to be able to grow and thrive. And then we can eat live bacteria foods if we tolerate them. So these are fermented foods, basically. If we have high histamine symptoms, which is really common in perimenopause, we might have including hot flushes, insomnia, anxiety, palpitations, but also that red flushing of the face, itchiness, allergy-like symptoms, basically, hives. So if we do suffer with any of those, we might want to be careful with fermented foods. I personally can't go too mad with fermented foods. So I'm going through a phase where I'm not eating any sauerkraut. If I have some kombucha, even a really good quality one, I'll get the flushing in the face. So I tend to avoid fermented foods a little bit. But if you can tolerate them, raw sauerkraut, raw kimchi, so these are fermented cabbage, fermented vegetables, kefir, preferably made from water or coconut rather than cow's milk, live yogurt, if you can tolerate it. We can also get live yogurt cultures from coconut yogurt, it's just a little bit more expensive. So those are ways that you can be supporting the bacterial balance, as well as all the different colors and types of vegetables and berries. Bitter greens for digestive health. So these are particular foods that help to encourage digestive enzymes and bile flow. So chicory, watercress, rocket, fennel. And then some supportive lifestyle habits alongside all of the nutrition stuff we've just talked about. The lifestyle habits really matter as much as what you eat. Sometimes you can have the best diet in the world, but if your lifestyle habits aren't working for, healing the gut, then it's just all in vain. So we really need to match the two. So avoid eating on the go or in a rush, which is what I've already talked about. Take a few slow, deep belly breaths before meals. So if you're feeling a bit stressed, you've just been you're working all day, you're rushing around, you're trying to get food ready, and then you find you just sit at the table and you're absolutely just stressed out to the max. Don't just eat straight away. Sit and take a few deep belly breaths before your meals using the 4-6 breathing, taking a deep breath in for a count of four and a long, slow out breath through the belly, mouth closed through the nose and belly to a count of six. And just do that 3 or 4 times. It'll only take a minute or two. Just calm your nervous system to tell your brain everything's fine, everything's safe. We can start to digest our food. And then chew each mouthful. I mean, I say 30 to 40 times, but there's no actual number of times to be chewing. Essentially, what you want to do is chew each mouthful to almost liquid before you swallow it. So my advice would be, put a mouthful in, make sure it's not too big. We tend to load on our forks because we're just trying to get things done quickly. Not too big of a mouthful. Put your knife and fork down as soon as you put it in your mouth and just chew and chew and chew and chew until you think this is, broken down enough now for me to swallow. And you know what that is. If it's not broken down completely, it's not going to break down any further in the gut because there's no teeth there that's going to continue to emulsify that food. You need to do that with your teeth. So just use your common sense and chew when you know that it's liquid enough. And then pick up your knife and fork to do the next mouthful. So yes, this will probably double the amount of time it takes you to eat a meal, but it's so important. And ideally stick to just 3 meals a day with no snacking in between. Because I mentioned earlier, every time we eat a meal or a snack or anything, the sort of tight junctions in the lining of the gut, even if they are healthy and really tight, they still have to open a little bit to allow the nutrients from those that food, whatever it is you're eating, to be absorbed into the bloodstream. And then they close again. And we want to leave a good 4 hours between eating to allow them to close back up and repair before they are called upon again. If we're just constantly snacking all day, we're just calling them to open and open and open and open. And that can lead to leaky gut as well. So try to leave at least 4 hours between your meals. So for me personally, I have my breakfast. It's not the same every day, but I have my breakfast, let's say about 8. And then I have my lunch about 1. And then I usually have my dinner around 6 or 7. So it's sort of 4 hours in between. Sometimes I sneak in some dark chocolate in between one of those meals, but you know, I am only human. And then aim for a 12-hour overnight fast. So minimum 12 hours, anywhere between 12 and 13, 14 hours maximum. I've got a whole separate episode on intermittent fasting and all that, so I won't go into it now. But for the reasons of, you know, leaky gut, prevention of leaky gut or repairing the gut, you want to make sure you are fasting for a minimum of 12 hours overnight. Again, for the same reason, just to make sure we're allowing that gut lining to repair itself. So I hope that's been helpful on the nutrition side and the lifestyle side. I hope it's empowered you with, you know, just sort of being able to understand what this all means, basically. And if you're navigating perimenopause, you're dealing with new or worsening symptoms, you're worried about autoimmunity, you have a diagnosis, you know it's flaring because you're in perimenopause, or you just want to make sure you don't get diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. If you're suffering with things like fatigue, joint pain, brain fog, immune issues, it might not just be your hormones, like, oh, this is just perimenopause. It could be your gut. It could be your immune system. They're also deeply connected. So as hopefully you understand from listening to this, the good news is that there's so much you can do to support yourself. But if you find that you would just prefer to get some one-to-one support, really, really personalized to you and your own situation, if you want to work with somebody like me, then I would love to support you further. If you want to go deeper, you can book a free discovery call with me. The link will be in the show notes. The link is on my website. The link is on my Instagram. It should be everywhere. Or you can check out my membership for ongoing support if you just wanted more of a sort of low-cost monthly access. Or, you know, join my mailing list, sign up for my free guide, which is on my website. It's on my Instagram bio. Follow me on Instagram, you know, whatever. I'm not very active on Instagram. I'm more on my website more than anything, and on the podcast. But yes, if you do want to book a free discovery call to talk about working together one-to-one, feel free to do that. I'd love to speak to you. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week. Bye for now. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy, or you'll also find the link in the show notes.